So it is 5 o'clock Tuesday. You are listening to KDVS 90.3. And as always at 5 o'clock on Tuesday, it's time for the Public Affairs Show, Office Hour. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And before we begin, I want to remind you that the views that are expressed on this show, they may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So, as we always do at 5 o'clock on Tuesday, we go and we knock on someone's door. You can hear me knocking there. And we find out something that's going on campus. We knock on some door and we interview some scholar about their research. What are they thinking about? What are they studying? What's taking place? What's the intellectual work that's going on in all these buildings here on our campus? So today I'm very pleased that I'm going to be knocking for the second time. We're going to be knocking here at Office Hour on a door at the law school. We have in the past, we talked with Elisa Ikemoto. So her interview is among those that's archived on our show. And this is our second foray into the world of law. And I think that the things we're going to be talking about today are of great interest to many people in our listening audience. But I also think that they're somewhat complicated. So we're going to try to translate for you some of the important issues that are facing America today in the world of law. And for that, I'm very happy to welcome to the show Bill Dodge from the law school. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
Right. So before we start to talk about law and various Latin phrases that people may or may not understand and different cases, we always start our show in the same way, which is we're interested in how our guests became the researchers that they did. Bill works on international law, human rights. And the question is, how does someone decide that they're going to enter into that whole world? So let's see what Bill can tell us about how he became first a lawyer and then how he became particularly interested in the intersection between international law and human rights.
So I went to law school probably for the wrong reasons, because I didn't really know what else I wanted to do after I graduated from college. This is a common story.
Yes, it is. But
before I applied to law school, I decided I wanted to have an adventure, and so I went off and taught English in China for a year and a half.
Mm.
And so that got me, by the time I came back to go to law school, I knew that the kind of law I wanted to do was international law, although I didn't really know what that meant at that point.
But simply the experience of living in China, you became committed to an internationalist view of your life.
Yeah, I think so. And I was already internationally oriented. My parents were in Peace Corps when I was born.
Ah.
So I was sort of born into the Peace Corps. I wanted to have some experience that was similar, but I didn't really know how to do anything when I graduated from college. But I could speak English, and I could speak it fairly fluently.
Right. So actually, I'm going to stop here, as I always do, because we so often hear our guests talking about experiences living and working abroad as important in shaping their life. So here's our moment to pause and remind our students that we have a fantastic program for education abroad, and that guest after guest says that going abroad changes your life and gives you that just new interest. So I wanted to just remind everybody about that. But before we go on, where were you born? Where were your parents in the Peace Corps?
My parents started in Liberia and then moved to northern Nigeria, and I was born in Kaduna, Nigeria.
Uh-huh. And you came back when you were still quite young?
2 months old.
2 months old, okay. But this does mean that you were not born in the United States.
It does indeed.
So if that does come up to be a legal issue, we've got your number on that one.
That's right. I admit it here.
Okay. So then you went to law school because you weren't sure what to do.
Right.
But you were committed to doing international law.
Right. And so I had a chance to take, in the spring of my first year, I had a chance to take a class called International Business Transactions from a young professor named Harold Coe at the law school. And I just was captivated by this class. I thought there were so many different things you had to keep track of, so many different pieces of law you had to fit together. Harold's a great teacher. He ended up becoming a mentor of mine, and he's now an author. I now teach international business transactions at the law school. I use a later edition of the same book that he used to teach me, and he and I are now both co-authors on that book. So it's sort of the beginning of a long relationship there.
Do you think you can put your finger for us a little bit on what was so exciting about that class? Sometimes it is just simply the person who teaches it, that there is that some people are just great teachers. But there, was there something about the particular topic, do you think, that that was particularly interesting?
Well, the fact that it dealt with other parts of the world made it inherently interesting to me. You could do investment laws in Africa, or you could do them in China. He also was able to convey the sense that there was just so much to know, but also the fact that you could actually know it, that it was not unmasterable. And that was exciting. It was like this whole world of law, not just U.S. law, but other countries' law and international law, and the relationships among these different bodies of law opened up.
Mm-hmm. Did it reflect in any way or make you rethink or lead you to think back particular experiences you had had while you were living abroad? Because you had just, you had been in China teaching English.
I don't know that it did. One of the most interesting things I did while I was in China, at least sort of from an academic or teaching perspective, I was teaching English, but I was also supposed to be teaching American culture. So I did a series of lectures on U.S. history.
Hmm.
And just getting the different reactions from my students to what I was saying was interesting. So, for example, when I got to the period right after World War II, and I explained that U.S. politics, the Democrats were beaten up on for having lost China. They were accused of doing this by the Republicans. The room burst into laughter because they said, lost China? It wasn't yours to lose, right? There were other sorts of moments where I realized that the way Americans saw things and the way people in another country would see their history are completely different. And I knew things about Chinese history that they did not know about Chinese history because of the particular way it was taught in the People's Republic.
Mm-hmm. So you did find, I think it's kind of an interesting parallel there between sort of how cultures look at each other, then moving to international law, how different cultures and nations relate. How do they get along? How do they see each other? Because now you're really down in the, you know, in the weeds, so to speak, with all of the litigation and lawsuits that different governments make to each other and international law. So and speaking of which, it's a pretty complicated area. So we're going to ease our way into this bit by bit and make sure that we can help the listeners follow us along, because you're interested then in, you said it's comedy, right?
That's right. International
comedy, which may be a phrase that our listeners have never heard of before, but whether or not they have, you're now going to explain that to us. You say in your article that it's somewhere between an obligation and a courtesy, so that what do we owe to other countries? That's a big existential question to start off with.
So that's a very famous definition. It's sort of between obligation and courtesy. And that comes from an old Supreme Court case. But I actually don't like that definition at all.
So what do you like better?
So I think of it as a principle of deference to other countries. And it gets manifested in American law in a bunch of different doctrines. So can think of it as a general principle of deference, but it cashes out in various ways. So it's the basis for when a U.S. court enforces the judgment of a foreign court in U.S. court. Comedy is the basis for that. Or when a U.S. court applies foreign law to decide a case. U.S. courts have started to limit the reach of U.S. law, the extraterritorial reach of U.S. law, using principles of comedy. Some of our principles of court jurisdiction are based on comedy, or the ability to dismiss a case in favor of another forum. So it's a general principle that informs a bunch of specific doctrines. And those doctrines are doctrines of law, and they are binding as law in the United States. They do happen to be doctrines of U.S. law, not international law. And so the real distinction that's important to grasp here is the distinction between international comedy and doctrines of international comedy, which are doctrines of U.S. law, and then the body of international law, which is treaties, customary international law, which is something else entirely and is binding on a different plane mm-hmm. than domestic law.
And it's presumably not based on United States law.
Not right? at all.
It's based on something different. Well, if you were going to tell us to sort of just give us a sweeping overview of, let's say, the last five decades, what kinds of trends do we find in the relationship then between American law and its encounter with the world out there? Can we generalize in any way? Does that make any sense? Or do we really have to just go on a case-by-case basis?
Well, the doctrines each have their histories, and they develop in particular ways. And sometimes those changes are actually driven more by what's going on domestically than what's going on internationally. Because we also, for example, have to decide in U.S. courts about whether we're going to apply Nevada law in a California court or Chinese law in a California court. In some sense, it's the same question, and we use some of the same legal tools. I would say internationally, you know, the period following World War II was a period where U.S. law was applied to things that happened abroad fairly aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
And in the more recent decades, there's been something of a backlash against that. I think a more conservative court and more conservative judges on the lower courts as well have become suspicious, more suspicious of international litigation. And that's probably particularly true in the human rights area, which is one of the areas that I've worked in.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to some extent, the choice of cases, the fact that many of these issues get litigated in a human rights context instead of a business context, has led to more suspicion of the phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
more suspicion of transnational litigation among those who are more politically conservative.
So in other words, for them, you don't as aggressively apply American law, just to make sure that it's clear to the listeners. For those people, you don't apply American law as aggressively around the world. You're a little bit more circumspect in trying to make American law rule the waves. You might defer to, you might have more deference to how the local, you know, when in Rome, the Roman, this is how
right.
the legal system works.
I mean, Judge Bork once referred to some of these cases as judicial imperialism.
Yes.
That we were trying to spread American law and the American way of doing things everywhere around the world. I think that's a false picture of what these cases have really been about. And some of it's also driven, I think some of the backlash against transnational litigation has been a backlash against certain kinds of plaintiff litigation. So some of the cases have involved anti-discrimination law
mm-hmm.
or, you know, if when U.S. law withdraws from regulating internationally, the folks who it withdraws from regulating tend to be U.S. corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a more conservative viewpoint, less regulation is better.
That's always a good thing anyway. Well, that leads us, we're going to come to this question about one of the reasons we have a lot of international law is because American corporations are all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to figure out how to deal with them and how people will deal with them. But let's go to the one of the cases that you write about, and it's very interesting, the Jesner versus the Arab Bank. So here we have to start with this is a lawsuit by non-U.S. citizens against the Arab Bank, saying that the Arab Bank facilitated terrorism. So they're trying to get some recompense back by litigating in the U.S. courts, even though they are non-U.S. citizens. So that's a mouthful right there for our listeners to follow. So first we have to bring them up to speed. How is it that non-American citizens are litigating in the American courts? And that leads us to something called the Alien Tort Statute.
That's right.
The 1789, you said.
1789, right. So the Alien Tort Statute is a provision in the First Judiciary Act, which is the act that set up the federal courts to begin with, right after we ratified the Constitution. And it provides that federal courts have jurisdiction over any suit by an alien for a tort only in violation of the law of nations or a treaty of the United States. Mm-hmm. So it was designed to allow aliens who had been harmed by violations of international law to sue in federal court rather than state court mm-hmm. to get some kind of recovery. Mm-hmm. The kinds of suits they were probably thinking about then were violations of the rights of ambassadors, piracy. There was no international human rights in 1789.
Yes, we're not talking about human rights at the top of the list.
But we do have international human rights law start to develop very greatly after the Second World War and after the Holocaust.
Right.
And at that point then, the human rights suits don't start getting brought, though, in U.S. court really until the late 70s.
Wow.
And in 1980, there's a case called Filardiga versus Peña Irala in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York that reads this language against the background of modern human rights law. And it says this is the plaintiff there was the family of a young man who had been tortured to death in Paraguay by a police inspector. And the police inspector comes to the United States so he can be sued here. Hmm. And they brought suit in federal court. And the court said, well, this is a suit by aliens. Mm-hmm. And it's for a tort.
Because
you know, a person has been injured. Mm-hmm. And it's in violation of customary international law because customary international law prohibits governments from torturing people. Mm-hmm. And so we can hear this case.
Under this. So we've got from 1789 to 1980s that nobody had used the Alien Tort Act in this particular way. But people are always looking around for new tools. It makes a lot of sense. So somebody's saying, so let's just go back again one more time to make sure that when this was originally put forward, it would be somebody who was maybe living in America for their job, as you say, somebody, an ambassador who has something has happened, somebody's killed his horse or something. So he can sue to try to get some recompense for what happened to him, even though he's not an American. And that was built in from 1789. Now in the 1980s, and people are looking to try to do things about human rights. It's lying around. This act is lying around. And they say, look, here's this great thing. And you don't have to be an American in order to litigate. So since the 1980s, presumably, we've seen a lot of work going around on this with the use of this tort.
There were a lot of cases that were brought in lower courts and decided involving other kinds of violations of international human rights. So extrajudicial killing, disappearances, arbitrary detention, and so you get a lot of these suits being brought, and then some being brought starting in the mid-90s against corporations, mm-hmm. usually for aiding and abetting governments in committing human rights violations. And in 2004, the Supreme Court decides the first of these alien tort cases that it hears, and it seems to bless this line of cases in the lower courts. Hmm. It recognizes a cause of action, a right to sue under the statute, which the statute itself doesn't provide. And it recognizes that right, but only for very well-established violations of international law, like torture, like extrajudicial killing, like war crimes.
Mm-hmm. So it has to be something that's fairly major, and then it is recognized. So what you're getting into now is the question of, can this be used to sue a corporation?
Right.
So this is the next new wrinkle in this.
Yeah. And so these cases had started in the 1990s, but the litigation didn't really find its way to the Supreme Court against corporations until the last decade or so. And the Supreme Court has now addressed two cases against corporations, one in 2013 called Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum, and then the Jessner versus Arab Bank case in 2018. And in both of those cases, originally, the court wanted to address the question of whether corporations could be sued at all, because a lower court had taken the position that a corporation can never be sued for violating international human rights under this statute because the idea of corporate liability for human rights violations was not sufficiently well established.
Mm-hmm.
This was a reading of that 2004 decision, SOSA, but it was a misreading of that of that decision. But now you have one court disagreeing with other courts that had said corporations could be sued, and the Supreme Court wanted to step in and iron that out, and it tried to do it twice and failed both times.
What do you mean it failed?
Well, it still has not answered that question.
Whether or not we can sue a corporation.
Yeah.
I bet there's a lot of listeners out there that would like to sue a corporation. So this is of great interest to all of us, because this is something we're all trying to figure out today, the question of what is a corporation and is it suable? But really this question, I mean, how much is this issue really about limited by, first of all, you're talking about foreigners suing in American courts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And also maybe foreigners suing corporations for human rights issues, which also is a very, we've got a very special category in terms of corporation.
And even more than that, in both of the suits that reached the Supreme Court on the corporate liability issue, in each case, the defendant was a foreign corporation.
Uh-huh.
So, which made some of the justices wonder even more, why are these suits going forward in U.S. court?
Mm-hmm.
And so in the Kiobel case in 2013, the court said that that the case needed to touch and concern the United States, and that the case brought there, which involved human rights violations in Nigeria by a Dutch Anglo corporation, Royal Dutch Shell, didn't touch and concern the territory of the United States. And then in the Jessner case, Arab Bank is a Jordanian bank. And while there was some conduct in the United States, they were transferring money through New York.
Through New York, right. That's right.
But the court said that the cause of action under the Alien Tort Statute should not extend to foreign corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And three justices wanted to go further and say there was no corporate liability ever. But Justice Gorsuch and Justice Alito were unwilling to join that position.
Mm-hmm.
And so the holding is just limited to foreign corporations.
So we'll have to come back on the show in the future and explain to us as this plays out, because I suspect there will be a lot of litigation against corporations and a lot of people who want to sue corporations for human rights violations, because one of the things corporations seem to want to do around the world is violate human rights.
Well, I don't think they want to violate
human
rights.
Okay, maybe want is not the correct word.
They
end up messed up in many of those, embroiled in those cases.
Corporations do business in some places where governments are not doing good things.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, you also have people protesting about what the corporations are doing. So drilling for oil in Nigeria has caused enormous amounts of environmental damage in the Niger Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And so people go out and they try and sabotage the oil company's operations. And the army comes in and tries and cracks down on that and kills some people, tortures some people. And sometimes the corporations take the army to where it does these things.
Hmm.
So they get tied up in it in one way or another. Sometimes you've got security forces that are protecting the operations that engage in human rights violations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what would you let somebody came to you and said, you know, I want to do human rights work. I would like, and many people have heard about the terrible cases going on in Nigeria around the oil. You know, what would you advise somebody who said they wanted to sue a foreign corporation for human rights? What would your advice be? I'm curious.
They're hard cases to bring these days. There are a lot of barriers that stand in the way. And I say this as someone who's been, got involved in my first alien tort case when I was a law student. So working for Harold Coe, my mentor. And he, it's hard to get jurisdiction over the companies because often the corporate entity that is engaged in the activity is not the U.S. part of it, but is a foreign subsidiary.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to satisfy this touch and concern test that the Supreme Court has adopted. You can't sue foreign corporations at all. In one of the circuits, you can't sue any corporation at all.
Mm-hmm.
You have to prove that the corporation actually did aid and abet
knowingly?
The foreign government? Well, that's another question on which the circuits are split. Some say that it's enough that the corporation knew it was providing assistance.
Mm-hmm.
Some say that the corporation actually has to have acted with the purpose of providing assistance.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's a question of international law by itself. What's the standard for aiding and abetting under international law?
Mm-hmm.
So probably more than your listeners want to hear in terms of the intricacies of aiding and abetting.
You're not encouraging them to run out and litigate against a foreign corporation for human rights. You're telling them the 9, 10, 11, 12 reasons why it's not likely to work.
Right.
Do you have anything that's been successful? Is there anything you point to that you feel, since you've been involved in this for a number of years now, is there anything that you would point to as feeling that this is what I see as a success? This is something that I think I can hold out as a model for our listeners to understand what you can do in these kinds of situations?
I think many of the suits, not against corporations, but against individual defendants, have been more successful.
Hmm.
And it ends up that a lot of people who have committed human rights violations end up coming to the United States. Sometimes they even come to the United States as refugees because the government, they used to run a government or have a high-level position in a government, and then the government changes. There's a revolution or there's a transition to democracy. And they no longer feel very comfortable in their countries, and so many of them will come to the United States. I think that the cases have been quite effective in articulating human rights norms.
Mm.
I would also say that even as the United States has stepped back from this litigation recently, as the courts have withdrawn, other countries have stepped in.
Hmm.
So the Kiobel case that the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed has been refiled in Dutch court.
Hmm.
And it's easy for the Dutch to get jurisdiction over the corporation because it's a Dutch corporation. The UK Supreme Court earlier this year allowed a case to go forward involving environmental harms arising in Zambia against a UK parent company and its Zambian subsidiary. So it's not just the United States anymore. And I think that that's a positive development.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say, you know, litigation is not the way to change most things in the world.
Speaking as a lawyer, you are saying this.
Absolutely. And so if you can set up programs within corporations to prevent the harms from happening in the first place, and many U.S. corporations do this, mm-hmm. and abide by codes of conduct, but those strike me as more promising routes to achieving widespread human rights compliance. It's better to prevent the harm from happening in the first place than it is to sue someone for damages after people have already been tortured and killed.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering, do you think that partly happens because of fear of litigation? In other words, that you and the people who work on these cases are there actively encouraging corporations, saying, look, you know, it's better for you too to do it at the front end and to lead with that, because we're out here. And even if we can't make everything work in America, look, we set up these models and other countries copy us. So do you think that's partly an indirect gain from the work that you've done?
I think so. Not from the work that I've done particularly, but from the work that people, others working on this litigation have done. Yes, litigation is a deterrent and mm-hmm. gives companies an extra incentive to prevent the harms from occurring in the first place. And it's also brought more visibility to these issues. I think that the corporate social responsibility movement would not have made as much progress as it has were it not for the litigation under the Alien Tort Statute and other devices.
Terrific. Well, that's a very optimistic point to end. We have come to the half hour, so we're finished with the first segment on Office Hour today. So we will be back with Bill Dodge, and we'll do some more discussion about litigation in the area of climate change, which I know is on everybody's minds. So stay with us, and we'll be back after some public service announcements. So we are back now for the second half of Office Hour. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And today we're talking with Bill Dodge from the law school about The attempts to use international law as a way to enforce human rights and to hold American corporations abroad and other foreign corporations abroad to, you know, to make them more socially responsible. And one of the other things that Bill writes about, which I found extremely interesting, is he also writes about climate change. Climate change would seem to be an obvious place for international law because it's by nature international. Climate change is by nature international. But I think for us, in order to understand the litigation around climate change, we need to understand a couple of these phrases that we run into in a law. And the one that occurs in climate change, which we'll use to start off our discussion today, is the somewhat cumbersome phrase, presumption against extraterritoriality. Okay, that was a mouthful. So, Bill, you have to help us understand, what does this phrase mean and why does it appear in your articles discussing, are we going to be able to use the courts to try to combat climate change?
Okay, so the presumption against extraterritoriality is a principle of statutory interpretation. It's a way for courts, when a legislature passes a statute and it's not clear what the geographic scope is,
To whom it applies
and where it applies.
Mm-hmm.
Courts will presume that it does not apply extraterritorially. And for federal legislation, there is a federal presumption against extraterritoriality. The geographic scope of state law is a question of state law, and about 20 states have their own presumptions against extraterritoriality.
Means outside of the state. This rule that we're making now doesn't apply when you cross state lines.
Right. Although it's a little difficult sometimes to tell, well, what does it mean for something to be extraterritorial?
Yes, I
so
can imagine.
Does it just turn on where the conduct happens?
Mm.
Or if you apply your law to conduct that happens someplace else that causes effects in the United States or in California, is that extraterritorial? And the Supreme Court recently, the U.S. Supreme Court, has given an interesting answer, which is you have to look at what the focus of the statute is. So if the focus of the statute is preventing harm, then if the harm occurs in the United States, it's not considered extraterritorial.
Right.
If the focus of the statute is the conduct, then where the conduct happens determines whether it's domestic or extraterritorial.
So that means that to decide where a law applies is going to be very complicated. It sounds like it's now going to be very complicated, and it's going to, or a statute or ruling, that you're going to have to decide on a case-by-case basis.
Right. Well, not necessarily case-by-case, but statute by statute. And
right.
Different statutes will end up having different geographic scopes. Now, the two cases. So I got involved in this issue mostly because I was asked to do some amicus briefs. And maybe I should explain what an amicus brief is. Amicus is Latin for friend.
Friend.
So these are amicus curiae briefs, or friend of the court briefs. And there were two similar cases that were filed, one by New York City and one by Oakland and San Francisco, that were both dismissed by the district court in part based on the presumption against extraterritoriality.
Right.
So I was asked to do amicus briefs in conjunction with some other folks. The clinic at Yale Law School worked on the first one, and then I sort of did the second one by myself in the Oakland-San Francisco case. They were trying to explain why the presumption against extraterritoriality should not bar these suits. These suits are... it's important to understand what they're claiming. They're suits against major oil companies, and they're traditional tort suits. They're nuisance suits. And what New York and Oakland and San Francisco are saying is climate change is causing us to have to spend all this money on things like seawalls.
Yes.
Or, you know, keeping the ocean out of the subway. Mm-hmm. And this costs us money. And it's your product that is causing this injury. And so we're not asking you to stop producing the product. We just want you to pay the money
for
that
the consequences
we're expending as a result.
Mm-hmm.
These are suits that are traditionally brought under common law, so not under a statute. And so one reason why the presumption against extraterritoriality doesn't apply to these cases is that there's no statute to interpret.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's back up, make sure that our listeners can understand this, because that was somewhat complicated. So you're saying that New York, Oakland, San Francisco, forward-thinking lawyers there are saying, look, we want to litigate against all these people causing climate change. What's a clever way to do it? Let's do it just as saying that, look, you've done this damage to our, we have to pay for these things. You should have to pay for it. They sued and they were dismissed using this idea of presumption of extraterritoriality.
Right.
They said, well, you're very clever people live in Oakland, very interesting people live in New York, but you haven't made a case because this stuff is outside of the territory. And then they came and they said, what are we going to do now? We're going to go call Bill. We're going to call Bill and we're going to say, Bill, we need your help with these lawsuits. We need you to be a friend of the court.
Right.
And we need you to help explain to the courts why they blew it, and they should, and that Oakland should be able to collect money to try to deal with the consequences of climate change.
Right. The people ask me to get involved not because I know about climate change, but because I know about the presumption against extraterritoriality.
I got it. I hear
and
you on that. They knew you were a lawyer and you could speak that international language.
Right.
Law.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think the important point to understand is that these are not these are not cases that are in some ways out of the ordinary. Climate change is a very important new threat. But the idea that a company may produce a product that causes a nuisance, mm-hmm, and that you can seek damages for that, people have been doing that for hundreds of years.
So it might seem to our listeners that this is a pretty good way to go with climate change. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. You're saying that corporations have been sued as nuisances for a long time. So we're going to use this well-trod path.
Exactly.
To fight climate change. So now we're getting all excited. I can tell our listeners are getting excited too. Maybe this is a good way to fight climate change, but then they get dismissed. You say it's already been dismissed at the lower courts by saying that this is just outside of the purview of this ruling. What would you say?
It's
technical.
Right. I would say that the key thing to explain to the courts of appeals in this case, and each of these cases will go to different three-judge panels, mm-hmm, one in New York, one in California, and the thing that the judges need to understand is that this is not original, out-of-the-box thinking. These are very traditional suits. State law has always permitted these kinds of suits. Yes, it's a new context.
Right.
But
it's
the
not
law
been about,
always
yeah.
develops by yes. applying old law in new situations
yes.
with adaptations. The judges who dismissed the suits thought that this was some crazy new litigation strategy for combating climate change. And it's really not. It's a very traditional strategy for combating public nuisances. And again, I didn't come up with the strategy. I think these are among the most promising climate change cases that are being brought. My role is just to explain why the presumption against extraterritoriality imposes no limit on these state laws, and particularly on state common law.
Well, that's pretty exciting, because I think people are excited today to try to think of something to do about climate change.
Yeah.
So if you feel that this is a good way that we can use the law to try to fight climate change, I think that's very exciting. So to look forward to this, what's going to be happening in the next while, just so our listeners can follow this? These cases are now on appeal.
Yeah, they'll be argued at some point in the next several months, both in the Ninth Circuit out here in California or somewhere on the West Coast. I'm not sure where the hearing will be. And then also in New York. And at some point within maybe a year following that hearing, opinions will come down, and then the decision, if the decision goes as I hope it will in these two circuits, those suits will be allowed to continue forward. And they're suits for substantial amounts of money. The suits are not going to stop the production of fossil fuels, and they're not going to stop climate change. They're not a complete solution. But what they do attempt to do is internalize the costs.
Mm-hmm.
What you have is a product, fossil fuels, that is causing harm
mm-hmm.
that the people who produce the product are not paying for.
Mm-hmm.
Other people are paying for it.
We're going to end up paying for it, right?
And if you can internalize those costs, the fossil fuels may become more expensive,
mm-hmm.
and that may help accelerate transitions to other kinds of energy sources.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But again, addressing climate change is obviously a huge task for our generation, for the generations that will follow us, and no single strategy is going to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. But I think it's a very interesting point you're making, that one of the things we want to do is we want fossil fuel to cost what it really costs.
Right.
And I think that in and of itself will be very important, presumably, as other non-fossil fuels become less expensive. Fossil fuels becomes more expensive as a result of this kind of litigation. So I think this is very interesting. Are you finding, in the same way you're talking about in the first half of the show, are these cases going to be copied a lot, do you think?
I think there are some other cases that are being brought. I have not stayed up to date on what. There's a great website at that Columbia Law School runs, if you Google climate change litigation in Columbia, that tracks all of the climate change litigation in all of the categories. These are really only two cases. I was listening on the radio this morning as I was driving to Davis about there's a trial going forward in New York, a suit being brought by the New York Attorney General against Exxon, which is really a securities fraud suit that Exxon has been lying about the extent to which climate change would impact its business. So there are various ways to sort of hold producers of fossil fuels to account.
And let a thousand flowers bloom.
Absolutely.
Let a thousand lawsuits bloom, and we'll see which ones go on and which ones don't end up working. I think one of the other issues that is quite confusing to everybody, confusing to me and I imagine to our listeners as well, which we touched on very briefly, but we really didn't get to explore, is the whole question about suing corporations and suing people. And that it seems like this has to be made constantly, the question of what is a corporation? That's something that we're all wondering about as we found out that now we know a corporation is a person, it seems sometimes. It seems sometimes that a corporation is not a person, is what you've said today. Just even in this little show today, we've seen that there are cases in which a strong distinction is made that you can sue people, but you can't sue a corporation.
Right.
And yet at the same time, we find other contexts in which corporations are said to be people. And I don't understand how that all fits together.
Well, I think no one thinks a corporation really is a person. The question is, to what extent do corporations have the rights and have the obligations of natural persons? And there's no one-size-fits-all answer to that question. In the Citizens United case, which your listeners may be familiar with, where the Supreme Court held that corporations have the right to contribute to political campaigns, and so maybe First Amendment speech rights, that was really based on the idea that corporations should be able to participate in the debate.
They can have an opinion.
Yes, and that they can express that opinion and have a First Amendment right to participate in the debate. It wasn't a holding that corporations are people. In the human rights context, the question arose whether corporations could violate international human rights, and if they did, whether they could be sued for doing that. Does the prohibition against torture, which you find in customary international law, apply only to natural persons, or does it also apply to what we sometimes call juridical persons, persons that don't really exist but are created by the law? And this was an issue that really came up for the first time in this Kiobel case. I was, for that year, taking a year off from my teaching and working at the U.S. State Department, and I got to work on this specific issue. And the U.S. government took the position in that case that the prohibitions against torture, genocide, extrajudicial killing applied equally to corporations.
What year was that?
That I was there from 2011 to 2012. Mm-hmm. And the Kiobel case was the case in which the government's position was worked out. So mm-hmm. this was the Obama administration.
Yes, just to remind us. So in that time, the idea was, in that case, obligations, when I were talking about obligations, that people have, corporations have the same obligations, would you say in that way?
They at least have that obligation. International human rights law applies equally, I would say, to corporations and to natural persons. I have to tell just one story from the oral argument in Kiobel, because I think Justice Kagan put the question really well in a question she asked to Shell's counsel. She said, because they had kept arguing, well, you don't have any cases in which human rights have been applied to oil corporations.
Right.
And she said, well, does the prohibition against torture apply to Norwegians? And they said, well, of course it applies to Norwegians. Well, we don't have any cases applying it to Norwegians. So how do you know? You know, we have cases applying these norms to Paraguayans, but not to Norwegians. Well, of course, there's no relevant difference between a Paraguayan and a Norwegian for the purposes of the prohibition against torture. By the same token, there's no relevant difference in terms of protecting against torture if the entity doing the torturing is a natural person or is a corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the question the Supreme Court has still not decided, but I think Justice Kagan's question suggests the right answer, which is that you can generalize from the cases that have applied this against natural persons, you can generalize and apply the norm against corporations.
Yes. Well, just to clarify that, I mean, Justice Kagan certainly makes it clear that it applies to all people. And then she's trying to move from people to corporations, right?
Right.
So that's the tricky move there, that presumably that they do things as a group. They are sort of a group person, and they also cannot torture.
Right. And part of the way you get there is you ask whether there's a relevant difference between a natural person and a corporation for this purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you look at the way the prohibitions against these human rights violations are phrased in international instruments, in the Convention Against Torture or the Convention Against Genocide, they really say no person shall be subjected to. The focus is on preventing the act. It doesn't matter who the actor is. It's not a prohibition of certain categories of people doing acts. It's a prohibition of the acts, period,
mm-hmm.
no matter who is doing them.
Mm-hmm.
And that also suggests that it's a norm that's broadly applicable, not just to individual persons, but to corporate entities as
right.
well.
Right. Now, that makes a lot of sense. And also, it seems like torture is not something that's ever going to be an acceptable outcome. So, as you say, very important human rights issues. But it's somewhat unclear to me now, and maybe that's really the moral you're trying to explain to us, whether we're on the way to corporations being more people-like in some way. And that's going to happen for good and for bad. But we're just sort of on that way, that the corporation is going to be seen more parallel to a person in more situations, having the right to make its opinion known, being held up for not torturing. Or is that make it much more organized than it really is? And it's just sort of like we're all over the map on what is the relationship between a corporation and a person.
Well, I think the answer has to vary depending on the context.
Mm.
And corporations are creatures of law, and they don't have natural rights. They don't have any sort of right to natural integrity or dignity. We only authorize corporations because they're useful to accomplish certain purposes. They're very useful for creating wealth,
yes.
for organizing business activity. They really, without corporations, our economy would not work in the sophisticated ways that it works. But the point is, we create them to do things for human beings.
Right.
It's not that human beings exist for corporations. It's that corporations exist for human beings. Mm-hmm. Some of those human beings are the people who work for the corporations. Some of the people who are own their stock.
Yes.
Some of the people are the very well remunerated folks who run them. They all have their roles to play. But it's legitimate for law to regulate and to limit corporations for the public good.
Well, that makes a huge amount of sense. But I'm just wondering if you can, we made them up. We made them up. And so we get to still make them up. We're still in charge of making them up. They haven't become robots out of human control that we cannot control. That, I think, is really well put. But I'm just trying to get, is there any kind of overarching view we can have of what's happened in the last couple of decades to how we think about what a corporation is? Or is there no, that's sort of the idea that just every different litigation is going to lead to different things? They seem to have almost be in my mind like these robots out of control. You know, mm-hmm. It seems like they have, they take more, as you say, rights. We wouldn't have thought of a corporation having a right before because, again, it's just, you know, we've made them up.
Right.
Are we in a time when corporations have a kind of an extra legal entity power that they didn't used to have? Or is that just how I imagine them because of some of the a few individual law decisions that seem to be so shocking?
I think it's the way people talk about corporations today, increasingly. What rights does the corporation have? Is a corporation a person? I do think that's the wrong way of asking the question. And it's always important to remember that we created these things and we can change them as well.
So how do you do that as a lawyer? I mean, what do you, you know, if you were recommending to law students to, you know, take that to heart, what would be a sign that we were, you know, what kinds of cases would you look to see and rulings that would make you feel, yes, we're in good control here. We remember what corporations are.
Well, I think you're seeing some reinvigoration of some of the regulation. Even currently, we talk about many legal scholars have been talking about the need to break up some of the larger companies, break up Facebook, for example. Elizabeth Warren has been talking about this in some detail. And there are legal scholars who think that that is the right way to go, that antitrust law, which is the law that regulates competition, used to think that big was bad. And if things got too big, we should just break them up because they're too big. It then got away from that and saying, well, big isn't bad as long as big results in low prices to consumers. And consumer welfare was the only thing that we would look at. There's a new strain, or it's not a new strand, actually. It's a very old strand in antitrust law that's coming back to suggest that, well, maybe we should break things up just because they're too big. Mm-hmm. And they, so that's just one example. We're not going to reconceptualize all of corporate law or all of regulatory law in one go. It's going to be case by case, regulation by regulation. But I do think that that's one direction. I would not be surprised to see substantial changes in corporate law and corporate regulation along those lines over the next few decades.
Well, that's very interesting. And Mark Zuckerberg is really unhappy to hear you saying that on Office Hour today at UC Davis, because he definitely does not like that.
Yeah. Well, if Mark is listening, sorry, Mark.
Right, exactly. Well, I think that's a very optimistic note to end on, the idea that we do have the capacity to break up. We've done that in the past. I'm old enough that I remember when there was one phone company, and we're definitely right. So I remember that, if you remember that. So it is possible. All you people out there who feel it might be impossible, Bill and I have lived through this, and it's been successful. And I think that's a very good note to end on. Then we'll be looking for these lawsuits. I'm going to be following this. Now, I finally understand some things I've never understood before, so I look forward to following them in the news. So I want to thank Bill Dodge very much for coming on our show today. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And I just remind our listeners that this show will be archived on OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com. I will say that twice. OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com. And there will be a link to Bill's website so you can download and read his cases about Tell your friends you understand the presumption against extraterritoriality. And also you can find our shows archived from the past as well. And we will be back next week to knock on somebody else's door. So what thought should we leave everyone with? Go sue about climate change, but just do it carefully.
Yeah. Litigation can be a good strategy in some contexts. It shouldn't be anyone's first resort, but it's not a bad arrow to have in your quiver.
Terrific. Okay. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.